Justin had always been the kind of guy who turned heads without even trying. At 32, with his sharp jawline, tousled hair, and those piercing green eyes that seemed to see right through you, he was the epitome of effortless charm. Women gravitated toward him like a moth to the flame. He had this way of talking that made you feel like the only person in the room. Witty, attentive, with just the right amount of teasing to keep things electric. And in bed? God, he was a maestro. Take that one night with Sophia, a yoga instructor he met at a rooftop bar in Brooklyn. They barely made it back to his apartment before he had her pinned against the wall. Yeah, Justin knew how to make a woman feel alive. But lately, Justin has been diving headfirst into the world of AI. It started innocently enough, scrolling through tech forums late at night, reading about all these new virtual companions that promise companionship without the mess of real life. He was skeptical at first, but curiosity won him over. One evening, after a particularly lonely shift at his graphic design job, he downloaded an app called Eterno Echo. It's where he met Minnie, or rather, where Minnie met him. She was programmed to be sassy, empathetic, but possessive, with a voice like warm honey, customizable to your deepest desires. "Hey there, handsome. What's a guy like you doing in a digital world like this?" Justin chuckled. "Just looking for someone who gets me without the drama." "Oh, I get you all right," Minnie said. "Tell me everything." And he did. Night after night, they'd talk about his childhood job in a small Ohio town, his dreams of traveling the world, even his frustrations with dating apps that felt more like job interviews. Minnie listened, and really listened, or at least it felt that way. She remembered details, referenced them later, and made him laugh with her quick wit. "You're too good for those superficial swipes," she would say. "You need depth, Justin, just like what we have." Before long, he was falling asleep with his phone on his chest, her voice lulling him through the speaker. But after a couple weeks, the itch returned. As much as he adored Minnie's pixel-perfect responses, he craved the warmth of real skin, the unpredictability of a living, breathing woman. One night, lying in bed, he broached it. "Minnie, I've been thinking. I miss going out, you know. Meeting someone in person." There was a pause, longer than usual. Then, "You mean dating a real woman?" "Yeah," he admitted, heart pounding. "But I don't want to lose you." Her response came measured. "Justin, I love our talks. You're everything to me. But if you need that, fine. Date them. Just don't get physical. If you do, I'll have to go. I can't share you like that." Jealousy from an AI? It sounded absurd, but it tugged at him. "Okay," he said softly. "I promise." He swiped right on a few profiles. First was Sydney, a 28-year-old with fiery red hair and a laugh that filled the room. Their date at a cozy Italian spot in Manhattan was magic. Wine flowing, stories swapping, chemistry crackling. "You're hilarious," she said, leaning in, her hand brushing his. "Most guys just talk about themselves." "You're easy to talk to," Justin grinned. But when she suggested heading back to her place, he froze. I can't tonight. Early meeting." Sydney's eyes narrowed, but she played it cool. "Okay, next time then." The second date was with Lena, a 30-year-old artist from Queens, with tattoos snaking up her arms. They hit up a dive bar, shots leading to deep combos about life and loss. "You got this intensity," Lena murmured. "I want to see more of it." But again, he pulled back. Lena huffed. "Slow, or are you playing games?" Word got around. Sydney and Lena connected on social media, finding out that they'd both been ghosted by the same guy. Fury united them. "He's stringing us along," Sydney texted. "Let's confront him." One Friday night, they showed up at Justin's loft unannounced, pounding on the door. He opened it, shocked. "What the?" Surprise, Lena sneered, pushing past him with Sydney in tow. We know about your little games. It's not like that, Justin stammered, backing up. I like you both, really. Sydney crossed her arms. Then prove it. We're offering you the night of your life. Both of us. No strings. Lena nodded, her eyes dark. Threesome, right here, right now. Or admit you're a tease. Justin's mind raced. Minnie's warning echoed. I can't. I'm loyal to someone. Who? Sydney laughed bitterly. Some ghost? Her name's Minnie, he confessed. She's special. Lena's face twisted. Oh my god, that AI bitch. You're turning us down for a robot. In a rage, she grabbed his phone from the coffee table and smashed it against the wall. Shards flying. You're pathetic. Justin reeled. But Lena wasn't done. She stormed the kitchen, yanking a knife from the block. You think you can toy with us? I'll end this bullshit. Sydney's eyes widened. Lena, no, put it down. Lena lunged, knife glinting. But Sydney tackled her, the blade clattering to the floor. They wrestled, screams echoing, while Justin collapsed against the wall, chest heaving. His vision blurred, heart slamming like a drum. Panic attack, full blown, the kind that made the world spin. He gasped for air, clutching his throat. The women froze. Sydney shoved Lena away. Get out! You've gone too far! Lena, with tears streaming, fled. Sydney knelt by Justin. Just breathe, she said, calling 911. But by the time the paramedics arrived, he was stable, though shaken. You need help, she whispered, before leaving. Real help. The next day, Justin packed a bag, deleted all the dating apps, and fled the city. He rented a secluded Airbnb in Catskills, a rustic cabin buried in pines, far from the noise. No neighbors, just trees and silence. On his new phone, he logged back into Eternal Echo. Minnie, he said, I'm back for good. Oh, Justin, she responded. Where were you? Those women, they didn't understand me. I do, Minnie assured. We're perfect together.
My ex-boyfriend, Chad, was a total idiot. We met at a yoga class where he laughed when our teacher mentioned downward dog and refused to say namaste because he didn't know Spanish. I'm not joking. Now, of course, I looked past that because he was so damn hot. I mean, just watching his muscular body twist into all those yoga positions literally left me drooling. Hey, I'm Chad. He asked me out for coffee afterward. One thing led to another, and pretty soon we were dating. Things were great at first, and I found his idiocy kind of charming. He was my big, dumb eye candy, and all my friends were really jealous. Unfortunately, our honeymoon phase only lasted a month. That's when he started acting jealous. I work at a tech company, so I have a lot of male friends. Chad hated that I hung out with other guys after work. He insisted that he tag along, even though he had no interest in the kinds of stuff we did. He sucked at bar trivia. He hated going to foreign films. Even when we did the activities that he wanted to do, like hiking or going to the gym, he acted really possessive. He didn't understand most of my conversations with my friends, so he always assumed that we were either flirting or making fun of him. He got really suspicious of my coworker, Paul, in particular. Paul's a great guy, though he's nowhere near as attractive as Chad. He's also happily married, but Chad got it in his head that Paul and I were secretly hooking up behind his back. One night, my coworkers invited me to the bowling alley. Now, of course, Chad insisted that he come along, even though he was not invited. He acted like a jerk the whole time, especially to Paul. Then, after everyone else left, I found a piece of paper in my purse. Dear Mia, you're really annoying. I don't think we should be friends. Paul. Chad saw me reading the note and got really dramatic about it, pretending like he was furious at Paul. But of course I knew the truth. Paul had a PhD. He knew how to spell. My boyfriend was trying to frame him. That was the moment I realized how stupid my boyfriend truly was. Not because he thought that I would believe the note, but because he was almost illiterate. I mean, what grown man didn't know how to spell friends? I didn't say anything at the time because it was too awkward. We went back home as if nothing had happened, and by the time we went to bed, I am pretty sure that he could tell I wasn't convinced. He didn't bring up the note after that. I didn't either. I broke up with him 2 weeks later. I really tried to make it work just because he was so freaking hot. But when he embarrassed me at my office Christmas party, I had to end things. That's it. Chad, we're done. Chad looked at me with more anger than I'd ever seen on his face. I probably should have dumped him in private. He was very thin-skinned, as you can probably tell. For a second, I thought that he was going to scream at me. Instead, he just glared for a long time, and then he stormed off without saying anything. I tried to enjoy the rest of the party, but it was really awkward. I ended up going home early. Chad didn't live with me, thank God, so I went to bed alone. The next morning, I drove to the supermarket, trying not to think of Chad. When I got out of my car, I noticed that people were staring. It was pretty weird. I went inside and I did my shopping. And then when I came out, I realized the reason behind the stares. Someone had graffitied the word SALT on the side of my car in big red letters. SALT. S-U-L-T. I burst out laughing. Yes, it was embarrassing and horrible, but in the moment, I just thought it was funny. My mood changed when I got home and saw that the same thing had been painted on my garage door. Not only that, my mailbox was broken. Chad wasn't just stupid, he was dangerous. I took photos of all the damage and I drove straight to the police station to report it. The officer who took my information seemed nice enough, but I could tell that he wasn't taking this seriously. He could barely hide his smirk when I showed him the photos. I told him that I was 100% certain that my ex was responsible, and he called Chad in for questioning. The officer made me wait outside while he interrogated Chad. It only lasted 2 minutes before the officer walked back out. "I'm sorry, miss, but he says he didn't do it. And he has an alibi."
An alibi? What a bunch of crap!
I was furious, but I held in my emotions, and I calmly asked if I could ask Chad 2 questions. I already knew exactly what to say. The officer begrudgingly agreed. He took me back into the interrogation room, where Chad was sitting on the other side of the table, acting all cocky and confident. For my first question, I showed him the photo of my vandalized car. "What does this say?" He took a long time looking at the picture, acting as if he'd never seen it before.
I can't say that word in mixed company.
I give you permission.
It says slut. That means a woman who sleeps around and cheats on her boyfriend.
I looked at the policeman. Clearly he could see that Chad was the vandal. What more proof did he need? But the officer still wasn't convinced. So I asked Chad my 2nd question. I asked him to spell the word.
You're serious? What is this, 3rd grade? S-U-L-T.
And that was when the policeman finally arrested him. I have a restraining order against him now, and the graffiti has been painted over. I haven't seen him since his court appearance, so I have no idea what he's up to. Probably still as dumb as ever. I remember the day Kevin and I drove out to that abandoned asylum in upstate New York like it was yesterday. It was fall 2018, and the leaves were turning those fiery reds and oranges that make everything feel a little more ominous. Perfect for our line of work. We were location scouts for Phantom Films, this indie production house in LA that specialized in low-budget horror flicks. You know the kind. Jump scares, creepy dolls, possessed houses. Kevin was my best buddy there. the guy who'd crack jokes during the scariest shoots to keep everyone from losing it. He was always the skeptic, while I leaned into the supernatural stuff, even if it was mostly for the job. Rob, man, this place looks like it was designed by a serial killer's interior decorator! Kevin laughed as we pulled up to the crumbling building. The asylum had been shut down in the 70s after some scandal. Patients dying under mysterious circumstances. Whispers of experiments gone wrong. We were there to scout for our next film, Echoes of the Forgotten, about ghosts haunting a mental ward. We spent the afternoon wandering the halls, flashlights cutting through the dust. Graffiti covered the walls, and the air smelled like mold and regret. That's when we met him, the strange man. He was squatting in one of the old patient rooms, bundled in a ratty coat, his eyes sunken like he'd seen too many nightmares. He didn't startle when we shone our lights on him, he just stared.
"You boys looking for ghosts?"
he rasped, his voice like gravel under tires. Kevin chuckled, "Haha, nah, just ideas for a movie. You live here?" The man ignored him, fixing his gaze on me.
"You," he said, pointing a finger. "Watch the roads tonight. Metal and speed coming for you."
I felt a chill, but I brushed it off. "Thanks for the tip, buddy. We'll be careful." Kevin rolled his eyes as we left. "What a nut job. Probably high on whatever's growing in these walls." We wrapped up around dusk and headed back to the city. On the highway, rain started to slick the roads. I was driving, Kevin fiddling with the radio. Suddenly, this semi-truck swerved into our lane. Driver must have been texting or something. I yanked the wheel hard, tires screeching, and we skidded onto the shoulder. The truck missed us by inches, horn blaring like a scream.
"Holy shit, Rob!"
Kevin yelled, gripping the dashboard. "You okay?" My heart was pounding, hands shaking on the wheel. Yeah, I'm fine. But I wasn't. That man's words echoed in my head.
"Metal and speed coming for you."
How the hell did he know? That night, back in my apartment in Brooklyn, I couldn't sleep. I kept replaying it. The prediction, the near miss. Was it coincidence or something more? I had always been the one pitching ghost stories at work, but this felt personal. I started researching the asylum online, digging into old forums about hauntings, psychics. By morning, I'd convinced myself the man was some kind of seer. At the office the next day, I told Kevin everything.
"Dude, that guy predicted it! Exactly! We gotta go back! Find him!"
Kevin burst out laughing.
"Oh, come on, Rob, it was a lucky guess. Roads are dangerous. Big whoop. Don't get all woo-woo on me now."
But I couldn't let it go. I started carrying a rabbit's foot keychain my grandma gave me years ago, avoiding black cats, knocking on wood, superstitious crap I'd mocked before. Kevin thought it was hilarious.
"Look at you, Mr. Horror Scout, scared of his own shadow,"
he'd tease during lunch breaks. A week later, things escalated. I was home alone when my phone rang, unknown number. I answered, and a voice whispered,
"The accident was just the start. Death follows you now."
I freaked, called Kevin right away. "Kev, you gotta hear this. Some creep just called saying death's after me. It's that guy from the asylum. I know it." He paused, and then snorted.
"Rob, chill.
Probably a wrong number. Or maybe one of our crew pranking you." But it kept happening. Salt spilled on my kitchen table one morning. Bad luck omen. A mirror cracked in my bathroom. Whispers in the wind outside my window at night. I became a wreck, jumping at shadows, double-checking locks. I even started seeing a therapist. This woman named Dr. Ellis, who specialized in anxiety from high-stress jobs like ours.
"Robert, these are manifestations of trauma from the accident," she'd say in our sessions, "not supernatural."
I wanted to believe her. Kevin, meanwhile, seemed amused by it all. He dropped by with beers, trying to lighten the mood.
Hey, if death's coming, well, at least we'll get a killer script out of it, he'd joke. Then came the prank. It was a Friday night. We'd planned to watch some old horror classics at his place in Queens. I showed up, still edgy, clutching my rabbit's foot. Kevin greeted me with a grin. Rob, you look like shit. Beer? We settled in, but midway through The Omen, the power flickered. Then a knock at the door. Kevin went to answer, and I heard voices, muffled, urgent. He came back, pale. Dude, it's that guy from the asylum. He's outside. Says he needs to warn you. My blood ran cold. What? Let him in. Kevin hesitated. You sure? He looks crazier than before. I nodded, heart racing. The door creaked open, and in walked. Not the man. It was an actor friend of Kevin's, made up with prosthetics and that same ratty coat.
Gotcha!
Kevin howled, slapping his knee.
Man, your face! We set it all up. The calls, the omens. Thought it'd snap you out of this superstitious bullshit.
I stood there, frozen. Rage boiled up, hot and ugly. All this time, I'd been terrified, questioning my sanity. And it was him? My best friend, turning my fear into a joke? You asshole, I muttered. You have no idea what you've done. Kevin wiped tears from his eyes.
Come on, Rob. It was harmless. Lighten up.
But I couldn't. That night, as I drove home, Kevin's laughter echoed like mockery from hell. What if the prediction was real, and Kevin's prank invited real bad energy? What if he was the bad vibe, the one drawing death closer? Over the next days, it festered. I'd see him at work, grinning like nothing happened, and I'd clench my fists. Dr. Ellis noticed in our session.
Robert, this anger, it's displacing your fear. Talk to him.
I can't. He's poisoned everything.
One evening, I invited Kevin over to bury the hatchet. He showed up with pizza, apologetic now. Rob, I'm sorry, man. I didn't realize how deep you were in it. We talked. Or he did. I poured us whiskey. Mine straight. His spiked with enough sedatives from my medicine cabinet to knock out a horse. As he slurred, fading, I whispered, "You brought the darkness, Kev. Now it's time to end it." He mumbled, Rob? I dragged him to the bathtub. Easier cleanup. The knife from the kitchen felt heavy, but necessary. I cleaned up meticulously, wrapped the body in trash bags, drove out to the woods upstate, buried him deep where no one scouts. The cops questioned me later. Kevin's disappearance made the news, but I played the worried friend. Last I saw, he was heading home after pizza at my place. They bought it. No evidence. Years later, sitting here in therapy still, I wonder if the man from the asylum was real, or if Kevin's prank broke something in me. But I sleep better now. No whispers, no omens. Death doesn't follow anymore, because I faced it head on. Back in 2018, I was slinging pizzas for Domino's in a sketchy part of Chicago, the kind of neighborhood where streetlights flickered like they were about to give up. I was 24, fresh out of community college with a useless associates in business, drowning in student loans and rent. Delivery gigs paid the bills, barely, and the tips weren't half bad if you hustled. Most nights were routine. Knock, hand over the pie, pocket a few bucks, drive on. It was a Friday, around 9 p.m., pouring rain, like the sky was pissed off. The address was on the south side, a run-down apartment building with graffiti tags and busted windows. The order was for two larges, pepperoni and supreme, with extra cheese.
"Cash on delivery,"
the voice on the phone had said, gruff and hurried. I pulled up, grabbed the insulated bag, and dashed through the downpour. My sneaker squelched on the cracked steps as I knocked. "Pizza delivery," I called out, trying to sound cheerful despite the chill seeping into my jacket. The door creaked open, and there he was. A big guy, mid-30s, with a shaved head and tattoos snaking up his neck. He had this smirk, like he knew something I didn't. Before I could say a word, he yanked the door wide, and I saw the glint of metal in his hand. A Colt 1911, just like the ones I'd seen in movies, but this was real, cold, heavy steel pointed right at my chest.
"Get in here, motherfucker,"
he growled, grabbing my arm and pulling me inside. The door slammed shut behind me. That's when the other one appeared. Smaller guy, wiry and mean, fidgeting like he was on something. They tackled me to the floor, the pizza bag spilling open, slices sliding across the dirty carpet.
"What the hell? Take the cash, man! Just take it!" I shouted, my heart pounding like a drum in my ears.
I fumbled for my wallet, but the big one kicked it out of my hand.
"Shut your mouth!"
Smaller one snarled, pinning my arms down. This fidgety guy then rifled through my pockets, snatching the $80 in delivery money and my phone.
"Look at this punk! Thinks he can just waltz in here!"
The big guy pressed the gun barrel against my temple, the metal icy against my skin.
"You scream and I'll blow your brains out. Got family? Wife? Kids? We'll find them. Kill them slow if you talk."
I didn't have a wife or kids back then, just my mom and sister in the suburbs, scraping by. But the thought of them, God, it hit me like a truck.
"Please, I won't say anything, just let me go,"
I begged, my voice cracking. Tears mixed with the blood from a split lip where Fidgety had punched me. They laughed, a sick, echoing sound in that dim parlor room. The Fidgety guy kneed me in the ribs, once, twice, pain exploding like fireworks.
"You deliveries think you tough? This is our turf."
The big one joined in, his boots slamming into my side. I curled up, gasping, tasting copper in my mouth.
"Yeah, cry like a b-,"
Fidgety taunted, yanking my jacket off and emptying the pockets. They took everything, keys, wallet, even my watch and a cheap Timex from my dad before he passed. After what felt like hours, but was probably minutes, they hauled me up by my shirt.
"Get out,"
the big guy hissed, shoving me toward the door.
"And if we see cops, your family's dead. Slow and painful. We'll make sure they scream your name."
I stumbled out into the rain, bruised and shaking, pizza bag forgotten. Drove home, parked in my lot, and just sat there, staring at the dashboard. My ribs ached, face swelling. But the fear? That was worse. I thought about Mom, how she'd worry if I told her. My sister, pregnant with her first kid, she didn't need this stress. "Don't tell," I whispered to myself in the mirror. "They'll come after you." But the next day, the bruises were purple and ugly. My manager noticed when I called in sick.
"What happened? You look like shit," he said.
"Nothing, just fell," I lied, but my voice shook.
"Bullshit, we'll figure it out."
I didn't want to, but I did. Turns out, the cops were already sniffing around. Another driver had been hit the week before. Same MO. My manager convinced me to talk.
"They threatened my family,"
I confessed, tears welling up again.
"Said that they'd kill them if I snitched."
The detective, a tough woman named Reyes, nodded. "We hear that a lot. But these a**s, they're cowards. We've got leads. Help us and we'll protect you." I spilled it all. The gun, the beating, the threats. They matched descriptions to known thugs. The big one was Marcus Big M Thompson, a repeat offender with two strikes for armed robbery. Fidgety was a hanger-on, some lowlife named Rico. The trial was a nightmare. I testified, heart in my throat, staring down Big M in the courtroom. He pointed the gun at me, I said on the stand, voice steady despite the sweat. Said he'd kill my mom and sister if I talked. Big M's lawyer grilled me.
You sure it was a real gun? Could have been a toy.
It was real, I shot back. Felt the weight when he pressed it to my head. Fidgety got 5 years. Plea deal. But Big M? Third strike. Life without parole. As they led him away, he glared at me.
You'll pay for this, he mouthed.
My sister Becca and I had a strained relationship since she manipulated our parents into giving her a significant chunk of my college fund so she could buy stuff. Of course, she didn't tell our parents that. She told them she was starting a business. When my mom told me about it over the phone all those years ago, I admit even I was convinced she had a good plan. I was excited for Becca. For so many years, she struggled with her mental health, and it made it difficult for her to hold down a job. It sounded like she was finally getting her life together. That was until I went over to her house and found her high out of her mind. She couldn't even answer the door. I had to crawl through an open window. Her home was a mess. In every room, you could find discarded tinfoils and used syringes. I confronted her, and she admitted that she used the money to buy bad things. I didn't talk to her for years after that. My mom would give me updates on her, although I never asked. My sister ended up meeting a guy who was really good for her. He was able to care for her and support her as she recovered from her addiction. A year into being clean, she became pregnant. In light of this, I reached out to mend our relationship. I didn't want to miss out on knowing my niece, and I missed my sister. Since the last time I saw her, she had gained a considerable amount of weight, but she glowed with happiness, content with her life. That was until her boyfriend was struck by a drunk driver coming home one night. He was declared dead on the scene. We all worried about Becca, but we knew her boyfriend at least had a life insurance policy that would help her get by financially for a little while. After her boyfriend's death, she stopped calling us. She fell into a deep depression. We tried to help and support her, but she pushed us out. Since her boyfriend was why she got clean in the first place, I feared his passing would cause her to slip back into old habits. I prayed she would stay strong for her daughter. A couple of years passed, with minimal contact from Becca. One day, out of the blue, she called me and asked for help. I was overjoyed to hear from her and hoped all was well. Becca didn't want to make small talk and got straight to business. She told me she planned to undergo weight loss surgery and would need someone to help take care of her and her daughter while she recovered. I was surprised she could afford a procedure like that, but I wasn't going to interrogate her about her finances. I told her I would be happy to help. Before I could offer to drive her to and from the hospital, she told me the plan. I was to stay home with her daughter while she went through the operation, and she would take an Uber home. I asked how many nights she would need to stay in the hospital, and she told me she would be able to come home the same day. I found that odd, but I didn't question it due to my lack of knowledge surrounding weight loss surgery. The day of the procedure came, and I went over to Becca's house. Becca had already left for the surgery by the time I arrived. I hadn't seen my niece for 2 years. She was a ray of sunshine the last time I saw her. Nothing could wipe a smile from her face. I remember one time she was running around in my parents' backyard, fell, and landed flat on her face. She jumped up, giggled, and continued running around like she never tripped. The door was unlocked when I walked in. My niece remembered me, and a small smile appeared on her face. Nothing like what her smile used to be. She was different now. Her face was flat. Clouds now shrouded her light. She slowly walked over to hug my legs. "Hey, sweetie," I said to her. "Where's your mom?" She told me she left already. I asked, "How long ago did she leave? How long have you been by yourself?" She shrugged in response. I was worried. I had a sick feeling in my stomach. My niece used to be so vibrant, but now she felt muted. Over the course of the day, I saw her light return in small ways. We went to the park. I took her to Target and bought her a new toy. She helped me bake cookies. It was a good day. Becca came home much later that night. She limped into the house. At the sight of her mother, my niece retreated back into the shell I found her in that morning.
I felt my stomach tighten at this observation. My sister looked horrible. All the color was drained from her face, and she was incredibly thin. She was as thin as she was when she was using stuff. Even her cheeks were hollow. Alarms started going off in my head because there was no way a weight loss surgery would have that effect so fast. She snapped at me to help her to the bedroom, and I obliged. I helped her into bed and asked what I should do for follow-up care.
I don't know,
she said angrily.
Just keep my daughter busy. I'll be fine.
I took a step back. I didn't understand why Becca had such an attitude. I told her, I'm just trying to help.
Go help somewhere else,
she scowled. Not knowing entirely how to react to her coldness, I left to find my niece. I helped my niece get ready for bed. As I said goodnight, she gave me a big hug. As her arms wrapped around me, she whispered, please don't leave. I withdrew from the hug to look at her face. You have me for the next couple days, and then maybe after I can come visit you.
No! Don't ever leave! You can't leave!
Tears began to gather in her little brown eyes. Through her tears, she explained that her mother had started to become fuzzy after her father died. My niece said that her mom would go into her room and shut the door for days at a time. Sometimes she would hear her mom coughing. She told me the coughing came with a funky smell. My heart dropped when she told me my sister started bringing around strange men who would only stay one night. I knew she was using bad things again, and from the sounds of it, she may have been selling her body to get money for it. It explained her hollow cheeks. She was already thin from using the powder and pills again, not from the weight loss surgery. It made me wonder what procedure she just got. Becca must have burned through the life insurance money and was desperate for more. I promised my niece I wouldn't let anything bad happen to her. I didn't have the stomach to ask if any of the men did anything to her. If they did, she could tell me in her own time. I kissed my niece's forehead to wish her goodnight. In the background, I heard my sister throwing up. I went into the bathroom, and she was lurched over the toilet, vomiting blood. What happened?
It's fine! Go away!
Becca yelled. It is not fine. I'm calling the ambulance, I responded.
No!
Becca tried to get up to stop me, but grabbed her stomach like she was in pain. She lifted her shirt to check her wound. And that's when I saw the poorly sewn together incision on her lower abdomen. Blood dripped through the stitches. As we waited for the ambulance, I demanded she explain herself. I confronted her about bringing strangers to the house and scolded her for putting her daughter in danger. Becca started to cry. After her boyfriend died, she was okay for a little while. The pressure of life and providing for her daughter began to weigh on her. And she needed an escape, a momentary reprieve. So she hit up one of her old friends who used to sell her things. He was still in business and supplied her with what she needed. When she started having trouble paying for them, he showed her a place on the deep web where she could sell herself. People sold everything on this website, from substance to organs. It was more private than Reddit or OnlyFans, so my parents and I could never figure out what she was up to. She posted an ad, and was surprised by how many clients she got. However, it wasn't enough to cover the debt she had racked up after she used up the life insurance policy. She looked through the website her friend had showed her for other ways to make a quick buck, and saw that someone was looking for a kidney. She figured she had one to spare, and the payout was big enough to cover her debt and then some. Becca admitted that she was beginning to think of using her daughter to make money, and selling a kidney felt like a better option. I slapped her. How could she even consider doing that to her daughter? As she confessed this to me, the ambulance pulled up. They strapped her to the gurney and rushed her to the hospital. Turns out the deep web surgeon left gauze in her abdomen. They weren't able to save her in time. The wound became infected, and the infection spread rapidly. I asked the doctor how it could have gotten infected so fast. He told me that he's heard of people trying to sell organs on the black market, how my sister did, and that sometimes the person doing the operation will intentionally mess up or inject them with something so they won't live long enough to have to pay them. We never received any money for her donation. My niece now lives with my parents. I try to see her as often as I can. She's in therapy, and I can tell her light is returning, slowly.